Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello, my name is Karen and I call myself the Chief Excitement Officer of my company Cryo Slices. I will be your host for this punchy, pragmatic and inspiring series called Risk, where we aim to reframe risk through a kingdom lens. I am so excited about hosting this series because the topic impacts everyone in a career or business. And having been an entrepreneur for over 25 years, spanning the entire supply chain from research and development in the medi and aesthetics technology space, right through to global exports and raising capital at various stages, I too have had to face risk on multiple occasions. Our guests today are Kurt and Katrina Aiken-Laird, two of the most inspiring and dynamic entrepreneurs and business people that I have ever had the pleasure of meeting. Not only is business tough to navigate, but when doing it as foreigners working in over 30 different countries, 14 years of which were in Afghanistan and now living in Kenya, you know you're going to learn a lot from them. So buckle up, listeners, because this is going to be fun. Welcome, Kurt and Katrina. There was so much to say about the two of you, so I thought it best that you introduce yourselves, tell us about your work, and please give us an overview of ReFrontier.
Well, it is great to be here, and thank you for having us. I will say a little bit about who we are, and then I think Katrina can talk about ReFrontier. Katrina was born in the UK, but 3 weeks later was in Sierra Leone. Her parents are both public health doctors, strong believers, working for the British government. And they spent 3 years there. So Katrina's first memories are from Africa. And so being that we're back in Nairobi, it's kind of a return to the continent for Katrina. I was born in Canada of American parents. And then we went down to Ecuador. My dad was a pilot with a Christian organization. And we went down there. And so I grew up on the edge of the Amazon. It was an amazing place to grow up. And then we moved from there to New Guinea, to the western part of New Guinea, which belongs to Indonesia. It's now called Papua. Unbeknownst to me, Katrina grew up on the other side of the island. So after Sierra Leone, they moved to Papua New Guinea, which is an independent country, and she grew up there. We met in Afghanistan, which is a crazy thing for two tropical babies to grow up in a dry and landlocked country. But we met in Afghanistan. We both fell in love with the country and then got married there and raised our family for 15 months. And then we left. We then came to Nigeria and spent some time in Nigeria, 2 years. Katrina was working for the British government, and I was writing a book and also doing some consulting on a pharmacy chain there. So that's a little bit of our story before Kenya, and we'll get maybe can get more into Kenya, but Katrina can talk about what we're doing in Kenya.
Thanks. It's so good to be with all of you today. And just this is a topic that I think is heavy on our hearts, that we feel there's a real excitement and opportunity to help reframe. So we love that you all are doing it and feel a real sense of privilege you've invited us into it. As Kurt said, you know, in many ways, we have a lot in common. We both grew up in frontier markets. But as we discovered early on in our marriage, we also had some really significant differences. So we'll oftentimes say we fought like cats and dogs in our first year, 18 months of marriage, and not on any of the normal early marriage stuff. It was all about big economic policy, social policy, etc. And the story of ReFrontier really emerges out of that. Both of us really wrestling through the question of what does it look like to create redemptive solutions to the world's greatest problems? And coming from different perspectives and different traditions, Kurt very much coming from a for-profit market-based approach, me coming from a much more developmental approach that was concerned with systemic issues of injustice, and yet realizing that at our heart, what we had in common was a real sense of urgency for what we talk about as shalom. So this is a biblical concept that really talks to the idea of wholeness, peace, and human flourishing. And so we, over a number of years, have been developing up what we now have launched and co-founded, which is ReFrontier. ReFrontier is an impact investment vehicle that is working to catalyze that kind of social and economic transformation across frontier markets, beginning in Kenya. So together we lead two hybrid parts of that engine. Kurt leads ReFrontier Ventures, which is an operating holding company investing in scalable and high impact businesses. And then I lead ReFrontier Foundation, which is really focused around equipping and releasing transformed leaders, and then measuring and maximizing the impact of our portfolio companies. We're currently executing what we talk about as an MVP, a minimum viable product, in Kenya to really prove out the strength and possibility that lies in that hybrid model that marries for-profit market-based capital with not-for-profit development expertise. And our aim really is to deliver that kind of sustainable, scalable solutions to some of the trickiest and most troubling problems. And ultimately, as Kurt has suggested, you know, we will talk about this probably a little bit later, but we both feel really called to the hard places. And our conviction is that it's a model like this that offers just the opportunity of being able to address those issues in places that are like DRC and Syria, Afghanistan, even where we both met. And so our dream and our desire is to prove out this model and then ultimately to be able to take it to the much harder places where we feel just really confident that there's such a desperate need, but also a really driving opportunity for approaches like this that bring redemptive and long-term locally led solutions.
Wonderful. I think I was right in saying impressive couple. And I think we really need about 10 hours at least with you to mine all of the experience and the wisdom and the knowledge. But Kurt, let's start with you. From the impressive list of places that you've called home, I gather you have a unique appetite for doing things out of the ordinary. How would you describe your approach to risk?
So I think that we need to completely reevaluate our approach to risk as believers. I think we have adopted the algorithms of the world, and in doing so, I think we have missed many opportunities. For me, I'm an engineer, electronics and aerospace. And so I'm in my early career, I helped design airplanes and the electronics in airplanes. And of course, with the known outcomes that we wanted to have, which was that we wanted to get an airplane safely from one place to another, we calculated risk. It was mathematical. It was, you know, there were algorithms. It was clear. We had a clear outcome. But when we are investing in frontier markets and doing business in frontier markets, the outcomes are different, are a different paradigm. What is the outcome we're looking for? What is the outcome that we even know that God wants for us? And if we don't know that particular outcome, if we don't know what's in the mind of God, how do we use the world's calculations of risk to decide whether to go in or not go in? Afghanistan was an adventure, and it was huge opportunity. We built a $1 billion company there, just on a business side. The impact that we had over millions of people, and most people would have called me crazy, or did call me crazy, to go into Afghanistan. According to the risk calculations that are the secular risk calculations. How do we calculate risk in a new way with God's outcomes that would then take us into places that maybe nobody else would go?
I love that. I love that. Katrina, you've been walking this journey alongside Kurt as your own dynamic individual with your own perspective and views. And I love how you touched on some of that iron sharpening iron in your marriage journey. I would love to hear your view on risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We're oftentimes asked as a couple where we have gotten the courage to go into the places. You know, I have worked in just about almost all of the most fragile environments that there are at the moment, whether that's Somalia or Yemen, Libya, Northeast Nigeria, Afghanistan. And I think it can be easy to think about our story or to relate to our story and see it as us just having kind of, I don't know, somehow outsized courage. And something that Kurt and I consistently come back to as a couple is the following phrase. You know, we talk a lot around the fact that courage is actually overrated. Actually, what God is inviting us into is a walk of obedience, one that consistently walks actually like through the struggle and through the risk, and that calls us beyond the immediate, maybe adrenaline pump, and in and through where that becomes really difficult. So I couldn't agree with Kurt more about this fact that so many Christians, I think, do approach and relate to the idea of risk, and even with that, to the idea of failure, in a way that probably has more to do with how, with the metrics and the algorithms that non-believers or the world has set out. We operate oftentimes with a very narrow aperture when it comes to risk. I would say is primarily driven from a place of fear, of scarcity. It tends to frame decisions as, you know, what does this mean for me in this moment, in the kind of immediate or medium term? And my overarching sense is that what we are invited into as followers of Jesus is actually to widen that aperture out. You know, it's embedded in risk is also this possibility of incredible adventure, of new places and new horizons. And so what becomes possible, you know, when we relate to risk from this position of abundance and of security, then suddenly we begin to relate to risk from a place that actually opens up new horizons. And I want to be really clear that, like, I'm not saying, and I don't think Kurt and I want to both be really clear that what we're not advocating for is an approach to risk that somehow like diminishes the importance and the gift of discernment that God has given for us to use. You know, that is really important. It's a question of like, what are we including within that discernment, and how wide or how narrow is that aperture? So, you know, for instance, like we'll oftentimes joke, I will never jump from a plane. I will never go skydiving because, and yet I will, Kurt said, I will like go riding horses into the middle of Afghanistan, you know, go on public transportation in a burqa. I will go into remote parts of Somalia, engage with Boko Haram. Like I will do all of those. Why? Because I'm really clear as to what's the cost benefit and where my aperture is for that, and where I see the opportunity is wider. And so there's a couple things in this. You know, one is when we open that up, then I think we both have an opportunity to reframe risk as opportunity, but also to realize that there is a risk of doing nothing. And this is where I see so many of us really missing something. We seem to think that the world doesn't move until we engage it, but opportunities come and opportunities go. So us not moving is also a risk. What happens if I don't deploy my money? What happens if I don't invest in a particular business? What happens if I don't go where nobody else will go? And, you know, for both Kurt and I, where that has led us into, like, hey, there has been loss and suffering and struggle and deep, deep grief. But there has also been the most spectacular adventure and sense of joy and fulfillment. And I would not do our life a different way.
I think part of that opening the aperture is to look at outcomes in a different light. Because we so often are looking at physical, tangible outputs and outcomes, And therefore, that feeds the formulas of risk. And it's right. We need to be doing that. And we lost four friends in 2010 in northeast Afghanistan. They went into the hills as a team to provide eye hospital services and clinical services. And they had a great time there and great outreach of health services. On the way back, they were assassinated point blank by a radical group from the Taliban. So if you did a calculation, if they did a calculation of staying alive, they would never have gone, because that outcome, the risk was too great. But if the outcome is something different, which we believe it is, then you calculate risk differently. And we're sitting here in 2025, and we don't know even the outcome of that, of their deaths. We don't know the outcome, but God does.
Amen. Katrina, you said you built for the hard places. I love that. Are we all built for the hard places as Christians? Are we all called to this life of adventure that you have both highlighted so beautifully? But particularly, I'd love to hear some of your own personal stories from both of you, the highs, the lows, some of your experiences in taking on that adventure with God, hearing his call, being obedient, going, like you said, without counting the worldly outcomes and costs.
Yeah. You've asked two great questions there. I mean, on that first of like, are we all built for the hard places? In the way that Kurt and I are, probably not. I do believe that there's a special grace and a way that God has built and equipped Kurt and I and us as a family. We've got two awesome kids. We're probably equipped and built, and God has continually given us the grace to continue and to remain in the places where he has called us. And I think the discernment to know when to leave and transition. Having said that, are we all called to go? Yes. You know, the Great Commission, Jesus didn't say like, stay now, therefore, right? Jesus said, go now, therefore, beyond. And so, you know, we are absolutely clear that you need as much or more of a calling to remain as to go. And the question I think then becomes, hey, what is that new frontier for you? Now, if you're living in South Africa, like where is that new frontier? Is that a new frontier in business? Is that in relationship? Is it moving out to the margins? Is if you're in North Carolina, South Carolina, in the United States, like where's the frontier for you? Where is God asking you to go there for? I do believe that God has created us for more than we believe or understand. And that there is a calling inherent to the Christian journey that is one that takes us past comfort and invites us into a far more extraordinary adventure with God. You know, both Kurt and I have had direct threats where we know that we're on a hit list. We were chuckling earlier in the day, remembering when we got news that there was a direct hit or threat against Americans in our specific neighborhood of Kabul. And Kurt went to bed going, gosh, I mean, I'm one of two. You know, we knew the other Americans, right? Like I'm one of two. That's like a 50% chance that's me.
Wow.
And he woke up at about 4 a.m. and suddenly remembered that there were two other Americans at sighed a big breath of relief. Oh, I was going, it's great.
25% now.
Only 25%.
I can go back to sleep now.
So, you know, I mean, there's maybe a little bit of a dark humor there, but, you know, just to say, I mean, this was part, it was a real part of our reality. You know, there was another time in which it was a direct threat against a Finn. I'm half Finnish, living in our particular neighborhood. And I can promise you I was the only one. And we, you know, I rang Kurt. I was pulled into a meeting by the UK embassy. I was informed I rang Kurt and we ran through a series of protocols for how to get me home safe. And he and all various guards were at the door ready to scoop me up. And ultimately, you know, God protected us. And we're sober-minded about the fact that God didn't protect everybody that we loved. In the year that I was pregnant with our daughter, we lost 10 friends. And that's separate from the story that Kurt's just shared. But, you know, the year I was pregnant with Soraya was a year that was so peculiar in that it was defined on the one hand by this promise of new life that we had really hoped and wanted and expected for, and yet also really defined by some profound losses and really violent and difficult ones. So Soraya's, in fact, named, her middle name is after a friend of ours who was shot and assassinated when I was about 7 months pregnant. So, you know, hey, you know, there are loads of stories and there are more and more that we could tell. And I think it would be important to say, like, both Kurt and I continue to walk through the grief that has been involved in the losses that we and others suffered in Afghanistan. I think also in the grief of seeing the state that that country is in. It's a place that, you know, to be frank, we thought we would remain and raise our family for much, much longer than we did. And so to double click on what Kurt said earlier, it is a question that we have wrestled with. By every worldly standard, Afghanistan was a failure. And the risks that we took in being there, in raising our daughter there, in investing our own money and our time and our life in that country, you know, for what purpose, for what outcome, you know, by every worldly standard, it was a failure. And what of our friends that died? Like, how do we understand that? Were they foolish? And yet for both Kurt and I, the place that we have sensed God continuing to call us is to one that says, God has not finished writing that story. The last page of that novel has not turned. And so we hold in tension the now and not yet.
I think if I said to somebody, there's a treasure in the middle of Afghanistan. And then I said, it's $100 is the treasure. People would go, eh, that's not worth the risk, right? It's not worth the risk. But if I said there was $1 billion in the middle of Afghanistan, whoo, suddenly the risk calculations change, right? There's a lot of people
who would pay somebody off for that.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who would swear that they would never go to Afghanistan who suddenly will go to Afghanistan. And then I say, what about that little girl? And I'm being melodramatic for a reason. What about that little girl in the middle of Afghanistan who is suffering from all kinds of lack of human flourishing? What value does God put on that little girl? And if I have the resources to go in there and be a blessing and bring shalom, bring human flourishing to that little girl, why would I do it for $1 billion, but why wouldn't I do it for that little girl? Now, again, I'm overdramatic, being overdramatic in one sense, but this is where the calculations of risk are about outcomes. And if we put on the mind of Christ for our outcomes and got understood what his outcome is, it would be like $1 billion. We would take the risks.
It's a challenge. I'm feeling convicted. I'm feeling challenged by this.
And we're not asked to be mindless, because we've also seen Christians doing mindless things that are unwise in investing, for instance. And if they would ask the Kenyans or the Afghans, should I invest in this or should I invest in this person? Many times we know they would say absolutely not. And yet there are too many times that Christians are mindless about some of these things. That is not what God is asking us to be. God is asking us to have a paradigm that is his paradigm as we look at these things. And that is different than the world. And the deception is that we take on what has worked, quote unquote, in the West for investments. We take on those algorithms rather than God's.
So looking back at all of these experiences and all of what you both have done, how would you say that these experiences have influenced your spiritual walk? Let's start with you, Katrina.
I'm chuckling because I think when I first went to Afghanistan as a single woman, my relationship with God and with my faith was largely a performative one. Now, that isn't to say that it wasn't very genuine. I mean, it was deep, it was personal, it was real. And I think I knew how to perform for God. And there were right answers and there were wrong answers and there were ways to behave and ways not to behave. And part of my journey in those years was actually coming to a place where suddenly I was confronted with questions for God that I had no answers to and I could not stay quiet about. A lot of my work dealt with human rights abuses and brutal, you know, brutality and deep suffering. And in my first couple of years, I just remember having this consistently, this picture of myself on a hill holding this banner saying there is hope in the Lord. And yet looking down at just this destruction. And I, the words that kept coming to me in that season were, Lord, I'm your fool who stands on a hill and says there's hope in the Lord. Like, how can I say this? Who are you? How are you good if this is what is happening? It was, you know, I was confronted by harsh realities that I could no longer stay quiet about and simply give the right, you know, Bible study answer to. And that began a really sweet but hard journey in my faith in which I began to strip away the performance, and I walked into a very different kind of faith, one that is, I will oftentimes say, you know, my faith is one that is defined and characterized by the struggle with God. I take huge comfort and joy from the story of Jacob, who wrestled with the angel of the Lord, or wrestled, you know, depending on your reading, perhaps even with Christ. He wrestled there for the blessing all through the night. And he would not let go until he had gotten that blessing. We are invited into a faith that is defined and characterized by wrestling with God for the blessing. And to be clear, that we walk then with a limp. There is a limp that I walk with, that Kurt walks with emotionally, from the losses that we have suffered, from the pain, from, you know, we have both struggled with the level of PTSD, you know, from the trauma that we've witnessed. And yet we've also tasted the blessing that comes from wrestling with the Lord. And so, you know, perhaps in contrast to my husband is gifted with the gift of belief in the sovereignty of God. He is a wonderful, steady anchor. and my faith is it's not volatile, but it's definitely more like emotional.
She's thrown a shoe at God.
I knew you were going to mention this. I once, in a moment of deep upset with God, threw a shoe across the room, effectively at God. I mean, the absurdity of this does not pass me by. But on the other hand, there's a deep comfort to the fact that the things that trouble my heart also trouble God's, that he knows me and he still loves me.
I find that so encouraging. And I'm sure so many of our listeners will find it encouraging too, because in our walks with God. We often hear these success stories and these big leaps of faith. And, you know, we walk often in communities where we think we're expected to be perfect, and we get stuck in that works-based type of walk, and we think we've got to be perfect with God. But what I love about what you've shared, and I think it's the foundation out of which all of this flows, how we go to the hard places, how we take those leaps, how we are able to be obedient, is through intimacy. And intimacy doesn't just mean the highs, but I just love that we can be so real with God, and it's an anchor, and it's out of which should flow that decision making, as opposed to just being reckless as Christians.
You know, we want to go into Syria. There's nobody that we've talked with that's willing. I'm going to make an exception to that. We just talked with somebody who is open. But in the Christian world, there's almost nobody willing to invest in Syria. And yet I helped rebuild a country just like Syria, i.e. Afghanistan. And there are billions of dollars to be made to bring that country back into human flourishing. And there's a place to be the hands and feet of Jesus, just to love them, to touch them, just to love them. Where are the investors? Because by the calculations of the world, it doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. But the Muslim businessman, the Aga Khan, that I helped build this mobile phone company, it was 51% his, he took the risk and brought human flourishing and made $1 billion.
So focusing on the business side of those projects, what kind of strategy did you follow to invest in and build up these businesses in the local communities?
So I think the most important posture to have is humility and curiosity. We as Americans tend to come in and believe that what has worked in America will work in frontier markets. Frontier market operators, the entrepreneurs know the solutions. They're, you know, they lived in the mud. They know what businesses will succeed or what businesses are needed. And so the first thing for me is find those trusted local entrepreneurs and get behind them, not in front of them. And I think this is one of the big mistakes of governments, is they're trying to tell the entrepreneurs what to do and which industries to go in. And I think the entrepreneurs need to be gotten behind. And in doing that, you also may need, and this is what we are doing, is building an ecosystem within which the entrepreneurs can thrive. Because in many frontier markets, entrepreneurs are very lonely. They're not heroes. Many times, and this is a really important thing, here the entrepreneurs are not heroes. And so when they're not heroes, then even social pressure can be against them. They get one chance to fail. And if they fail, their mothers and their fathers and their community say, see, we told you, come on back, get a regular job. You're never going to get married. You're never going to amount to anything. So there is a place to build an ecosystem, a community, because of course, most frontier markets are very community based, that within which you give the protection. And some of this gray hair that I have is a benefit, because I can provide some protection with my Kenyan or with my Afghan colleagues, where young entrepreneurs can come up and prosper. The Americans come in and try to find the Elon Musk, the Mavericks, the iconoclasts, the rebels. And generally, that's not what works in these places. And so you need to be in the mud. If you're an investor from outside, you need to find people who are in the mud, who are partnered with local entrepreneurs and come in with a humility and a curiosity.
And in those situations and circumstances, Kurt, you know, we've talked about risking with God where we're not taking the worldly risk factors into play. Do you bring some of that in? Do you look at it? How do you look at mitigating your risks when you've invested in some of those entrepreneurs and startups? Is mitigating the risk being in the mud with them, or are there other measures?
You know, again, and this is where, again, like if you're an aerospace engineer, right, you mitigate the risks. You calculate, you use computers, you use forecasts, you use testing, you use all of those things to mitigate the risk. So there are ways you've got to use your brain. God gave us a brain, and we have a long-term view. We have a long-term outcomes. We have, you know, we're looking to the end, not to 7 years in exit. And that then allows us to be patient, allows us to know that if we develop leaders within our businesses, that those leaders, the hockey stick that we're looking for to return investments is going to come at year 13, 14, 15, not 5, 6, 7, right? And so that gives us a different way of looking at things.
Where would the people like you in South Africa and in my time of building businesses, because most of the investors, venture capital, private equity, that we eventually ended up partnering with, all have a 5, maximum 7 year exit strategy. And when you're in the tech industry, we were told, when I was in a business incubator, in a workshop, right at the very starting point, I didn't even have a prototype. A gentleman came in to do a workshop with us and he said, "You guys in the pharma industry have a 1 in 20,000 chance of taking a new tech from concept to return on investment, and it's going to take you decades, a couple of decades." And most investors don't understand that, and especially so much more in frontier markets or emerging markets like ours, where we have greater challenges that face us and different challenges that face us.
Similar to the risk calculations that Christians have adopted that are of the world, many have adopted the same kind of outlook of venture capital, private equity, and all the negative things that come with it, whether it's predatory or whether it's too short term. And what sometimes people will say, no, I think long term. But then when it comes to actually putting the money down, they're not thinking long term. Now, many times we can say, well, it's long term and we don't really care about the returns, and it's really la-di-da-di-da about excellence. And I'm saying, guys, if there's families here in Kenya who are long-term investors and they've made huge returns, why shouldn't we? If the Aga Khan, who is a progressive Muslim businessman, makes he demanded 35% EBITDA ratio from us in our mobile phone company in Afghanistan, 35%. And he said, you know what? You will get 35% and you will not compromise impact, social impact. And we said, it's impossible. And he said, with integrity, without taking bribes, and you're going to have impact. And we said, we can't do it. He said, well, I'll find somebody who can. And so we did it. 35% EBITDA ratio and huge, huge impact.
I was thinking as Kurt was talking, you know, it is a fallacy and a fantasy to think that you can live your life without risk. So let's just start there, right? Like, if that's our base camp, is life is risky, welcome to the game show, then the question maybe becomes, okay, well, let's understand what those risks are and understand what is the game that I'm playing. Like, what am I walking towards? And we oftentimes talk about in frontier markets is, I think, two key pieces that you guys were bringing out. One is that it's not that frontier markets are by necessity more risky. They are different risks that are often less understood by foreign investors. And so this points to the real criticality of, I think, foreign investors really being prepared to come alongside, take the time to discern which local partners they partner with, and then walking in such a way that allows those local partners to actually inform both what are their risks and what are the ways in which we mitigate that. So when we come in and we do due diligence, there's a really important need for due diligence. And I believe that that can be something that is very spirit-led. And we want to be thinking about the ways in which we do due diligence. So for instance, you know, do we come in and we're like, yep, give me all of your books, your financial books. And then we assume that all of that is legit. Well, maybe. Now, depending on the frontier market that you're talking about, you know, Kurt and I remember having a group come in ready to invest in Afghanistan. They were like, oh yeah, and we got certified books from all of these companies. And Kurt and I burst out laughing, be like, mate, I can buy those for you. Like, give me half an hour, right? Couple thousand dollars in a half an hour.
I can returns.
Audited returns, that's what it was.
A local partner of a big six firm, and I can buy it for $5,000.
Now, here's the thing. That could freak you out. Or you can say, okay, great. We work that into our calculation. So how do we actually get a legitimate understanding of where the financial returns are and the financial health of this company? And there are ways to be able to do that. But the way you're going to work that through is going to be different. So some of this is about understanding, hey, what are the risks? Yes, those risks are there, but risks are there in North America, right? In Western Europe. I think the other thing is then, you know, are we calculating our risk within the framework of a structure, a fund structure, or investment structure that is ill-suited for the environment within which we're investing? So you all were talking about, you know, 7-year exit, for instance. Well, hang on a minute. Like that implies there are certain risks to that approach. Well, what about if we began to experiment with what other kinds of funding structures or investment structures might be available to us that actually then totally change where our risk assessment is?
Doing business in frontier markets is not harder. It's different hard. That's my experience. People that say that it's harder are usually looking at things that from their perspective, for instance, corruption, Forex challenges are things that they don't know what to do with. They don't deal with that in Europe and US. And so to them, it's like they paint it as harder. And in many ways, there are pieces of it that are harder. Corruption is hard. Forex is hard. Dealing with certain skills that are not in the market is hard. But frontier markets are lands of opportunity. And very often the competition is minimal. So if you weigh the two, yes, it's harder in logistics, Forex, whatever, but you actually have very little competition in your area, or you can easily distinguish yourself from whatever competition is there by world-class systems, whatever. On the balance, business is hard. But on the balance, it's no harder. Frontier markets are where the most opportunity lies. Emerging markets are where there's lots of opportunity, but you begin to get more players, you have more infrastructure, you have more of almost everything, more policy, more stability. Frontier markets are the places that if you are going wise, just like the Aga Khan went into Afghanistan, and you're wise about it, oh my word, the chance of being able to build a $1 billion company and have massive social impact is far greater than in developed countries. I'll just give an example. I'll just give a really quick example. Go into Syria and we build a cement block factory. It is not sexy at all. But that country has been bombed into oblivion. What do they need? What a way to bless that country. What a way to employ Syrians. What a way to be in there in a redemptive way. And I want to be an invitation to people to join in with that. Yes, there is risk, but my word, the rewards and the joy that comes out of it is worth the risk.
I'm sure our listeners can hear the joy, but I can physically see the joy and the energy and the adventure and the living lives of purpose and adventure with God. It's very, very exciting. So as an ecosystem of impact investing and development, what are the outcomes that you're willing to risk for and why? Or put another way, if you could do a pitch, this is your opportunity, to a group of Christian investors right now, what would you say to them to persuade them that a particular risk is worth it?
I think fundamentally my answer to that question is, like, what is worth the risk? People. Now that sounds really, has the potential to sound really flippant. And I, you know, I've spent two decades in the international development sphere. My parents were public health doctors. Over the last 6 months, we've seen the total and entire dismantling of the foreign development assistance system that has been critical to keeping, I mean, thousands upon thousands alive. Now, we could have a whole other podcast that delves into the whys and the hows and the ifs and the whens of the ways in which that needed drastic reform. And I would be like first singing that song. And at the same time, you know, I have felt really troubled recently, just sitting where we sit in East Africa, having the relationships that we have with people in West Africa, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, and really, you know, the privilege, but it's a terrible privilege of actually having such deep friendships that we are seeing and experiencing the real impact of that on people's lives. Just a couple of weeks ago, Kurt and I were in a community just around the corner from us with an organization that we partner with. And somebody was sharing that, you know, their organization provided antiretroviral drugs to young girls. And suddenly the tap had been turned off. And that meant that people weren't getting the treatment, that there's higher levels of spreading the disease, including to their children. Most of these women and girls, you know, they had contracted it not through any sort of a decision that they had made, oftentimes through their husband or, you know, through perhaps even through a parent. And those sorts of examples are happening globally. And as Christians, for so many of us, you know, I think there is a heart of missions oftentimes that has been such a beautiful thing that wants to go into it and to heal and to serve the people at the margins. And yet in this moment, there is this space where, you know, I can't help but look at the world and go, the house is on fire. The house is on fire. I find myself increasingly wanting to shout from the hilltops, like, now is the time, not just to fill a gap that is suddenly being, has been very, very suddenly left of life-saving services, but actually to entirely reimagine what it could look like to begin to address and tackle the world's deepest problems. And my heart and desire is, like, we have an opportunity here and now to deploy an extraordinary level of capital, but submitted to and in partnership with the people who live in these contexts, and to reimagine a way of bringing about, bringing about human flourishing that upturns entrenched hierarchies, that invites a level of depth of partnership, that deploys, you know, kingdom gifts in all of their diversity. And that is done insofar as, one, we are prepared to actually, like, go. Are you prepared to go? Now, where is God calling you to go? As we said earlier, like, that may be physically going. It may be, hey, are you willing to sell your company? Or are you willing to give at a level that feels sacrificial and may actually mean you need to redesign your life right? Are you willing to go perhaps just to that community around the corner that is different from you, that sees the world differently from you? Now, for Refrontier, what we're saying is, hey, here's an opportunity to address some of the world's most critical, pressing challenges and problems that are literally affecting people's lives. They are living and dying. We have a portfolio of programs that is centered around closing the gap to quality healthcare. 70% of Kenyans live over 2 hours away from quality healthcare. And the impact of that isn't just that they get sicker, it's that they and their families have diminished economic returns. It is the leading driver that flips people out of the middle class and back into poverty. 30% of pharmaceuticals in this country are counterfeit. And so we are working through investments in a wholesale pharmaceutical company, in a combined pharmacy supermarket chain. And third, what we are anticipating is an investment in a health data analytics company that is addressing the wholesale injustice of the fact that something like 2% of the globe's health data comes from this continent, from Africa. 2% globally of the information and data that is used to inform pharmaceutical development, diagnostic protocols, treatment comes from this, even though Africa holds about 25% of the global health burden. So I, you know, the invitation to investors, but also the invitation to people who maybe are workers and have skills and talents is, hey, where is God calling you to go? Because the house is on fire and you've got the hose pipe. God has chosen to work with us. The house is on fire and you have the hose pipe.
We'd love to hear from you, Kurt.
You know, I'm not gonna pitch. I don't fully understand the American culture, even though I'm an American. I don't understand European culture. I'm married to a European. I've lived most of my life in places like this, and I love it. And so I don't know, I'm not skilled enough to pitch. What I would say is obey. If God has put something, a niggling in your spirit, a leaning, a yearning, combined, there's all the fear, there's all the unknown, there's everything there. There's every excuse, every single excuse. And I just say, obey.
Very inspiring. Thank you so much. Any last comments from either of you?
I'm so struck as we're closing this conversation. I'm so struck that, you know, we're talking about risk. And yet at the end of this conversation, what I feel is just such a joy and a sense of privilege that we get to take the risk. And I think that is the invitation for so many of us is, hey, what if we thought like, hey, what's the risk I get to take today? And what is God doing because of that? There is such joy and freedom and liberty and abundance in that space. And is it hard? Woo, yeah. And so worth it every day, all the time.
Kurt and Katrina, wow. Thank you so, so much. It's been a joy and a privilege to spend time with you. I feel we could go another 10 hours, but we are so grateful for your time. Thank you so, so much. God bless you
both. You're so grateful. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, and thank you for all you're doing to get this important subject out there and to be thinking it through. So thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.